yet.
Before I finish, I want to find out a little bit about where we are in Stillorg.
Where we are in yeah. Stillorg, yeah.
Could you, because you grew, you lived all your life here.
Yes, yeah.
What about this house? When did you take on this house?
Well, now, when I took on this house, this house was built in 1935. And
the address here again is
Casa del Rey, Stillorg. Yeah. It was built by Kathleen's mother.
Oh, Kathleen, hello.
Yes.
Yes. Do you want a cup of tea? That's what I just wanted.
But could you tell me, this house was built in
1935. 34.
Yeah,
yeah,
the lease was 34.
Yeah.
I don't know when they actually started the building, but it would be 35, I suppose, when they were building.
So it was your family home, wasn't
it? Your family home, yes.
Oh, I see.
I had been born in a house across, which is now the Orchard Inn, the pub, with the thatched roof.
That was your family home?
No. There were three houses there, that the pub, there was the pub, the publican's house, the teacher's house. My father was a guard, it was a guard's house, and then there was the bootmaker, the cobbler.
And what was your maiden name?
Nolan.
And who were the people living beside you?
Dowdles. She was the school teacher in Kilmacud School, the St. Lawrence School now.
All right. So you lived in one of these houses?
Well, in one of those houses there.
Yeah.
And the pub was sold, naturally. Mrs. Cullen died, and her son didn't take it over, he was an engineer, and he sold it. And then they extended bit by bit. But we moved over here in 1938. The delay was that the church in Mount Marion was being built, a small church there. It's now the town,
the community hall.
But the priest in the parish here came to my mother, and he said to her, would she think of letting the house for a year and a half, because he could get a very good foreman, but the condition was that he had to supply him with a house. And the man, there were no houses in Stillorg suitable for renting to somebody like that who wanted to bring his family. And he asked my mother, would she do it? And money was always scarce, and she thought, well, we're all right where we are. we'll let them in. So they moved in, the man, what was his name? Let me think.
McCarthy. Which was that?
No, Richard Wilson, was it?
Oh, Wilson.
Wilson was the name of the man who was coming, foreman. I don't know whether he was a foreman or an engineer, I'm not quite sure. But he moved in, and his wife's father also moved in with them. And he was a man called Leslie King McGee. And after some time they were here, this was the only bungalow in Stillorg at that time. That was 1935. Yeah. And lo and behold, there was another bungalow built up on the Kilmacud Road.
Yeah.
And their postal address was always the bungalow in Stillorg. And they came to my mother and said their post was getting confused with the post of the other bungalow in Stillorg. And my mother was busy, I don't know what, but at the time, my father had died, and I had a stepfather, and he was one of these men, oh, let him put any name on it, don't be worrying about names. And my poor mother thought they'd put St. Patrick or St. Jude or something like that on it, but they put Casa del Rey. This
man had
spent a lot of time in Mexico.
Yeah.
And he was a Spanish speaker, and he thought he was king. So in deference to him, they called it the House of the King. She was Leslie King McGee.
That's very appropriate. But could you tell me, growing up in Stillorg in the 1930s, was it a small village?
It was a small little village, all to one side. If you look out the window there, you'll see going up the hill, everything was there. You went up Kilmacud Road, everything was on the right-hand side, and it was a place of high walls and large estates. and the local people worked in these big houses. And then there was the small cottages going up the Kilmacud Road where they had no water. We always had water down here because we were on the main road. But they didn't have water in their houses. And the hill, they didn't have water. And a sewage system had come in. That was compulsory. And of course, the landlords put in the sewage because it was compulsory, but they didn't put taps into the houses. And they had to come down the hill to the pumps to get water. And that continued until, when would it have been, Paddy? Well into the 40s.
Which was that?
The taps.
Any water. The fountains were there up to the demolition of the village.
Oh, well, then as it came up to the 60s, it was there, that people had to come out
for water. The water supply was out on the pathway.
Yeah.
And there were fountains and people had to come out of their house with buckets.
There was a man living down the road here, quite a distance down, and he had no water. Well, he was away from the village, so he wasn't with a group of people. But that was one thing. But other than that, the men had no jobs. There were no jobs for men around Stillorgan. And the women worked. The women worked in these houses. Big houses, farmers' houses. There was a big farm here on the hill. And, you know, people had come to invest some money in large estates around. And then there was also the military hospital in Leopardstown. A lot of the women worked up there. But the men seemed to stand around the corner. A lot of people, they stood around the corner. A lot of unemployed people. But then I suppose there were lots of other men who were working.
Was there social welfare at that time? I don't think it came in until...
I don't know what they lived on. Yeah. There must have been something for the ones who were unemployed, but there was great unemployment.
There was a dole brought in, the early 1930s, there was a dole brought in, but it was a very small amount. And then they had the old age pension, of course, was there for older people, but it was very small. The rents were very small on the houses, of course, naturally, the local landlord here, and the houses were very small themselves. Most of the cottages there were two-roomed houses, just two rooms in them, one in front and one behind it. And then, of course, and there was a toilet in the backyard, you see. The sewerage was there, all right, and they had toilet accommodation. But most of them then built kitchens onto their houses, you know, small kitchens.
And the name itself, Stillorgan, would suggest that there was a still out here.
Is which Stillorgan?
Yeah.
Stillorg means the house of Larns. Now, local law would tell you it's St. Larns O'Toole, but there is no evidence to show that St. Larns O'Toole ever had any connection with Stillorgan. But there was an old tomb found in the 18th century over in Round Obelisk Park here, you know, towards Newtown Park there. And there was a stone on it called Larns, with the name Larns on it. And they assumed that this was a local chieftain and that the name probably came from him, you see. Tidlar Khan, the House of Larns, you see. And the local church here is now the Church of St. Larns O'Toole, the Catholic Church here in Stillorgan. The Church of Ireland Church is St. Bridget's, because they were linked to the monastery in Kildare, which was St. Bridget's monastery, you see, and they got the name St. Bridget's. And the original church here was dedicated to St. Larns of Rome, Larns the Deacon, Lawrence, and St. Cuthbert, who was the abbot of Lindisfarne in England. Lindisfarne is the famous monastery in England. He was the abbot there and became a saint like Saint Finian or any of the abbots who became saints in Ireland, you know.
So in fact there was a lot of ecclesiastical
action
going on here, properties.
Yes.
But, you know, to bring it more up to date, and you know, the places like the bowling alley and all of that, when did Stillorgan start to grow then? And when did you notice?
Around about the 60s, wasn't it, they began to grow?
The 60s, yeah. When began to grow after the war. It was all right after the war, the city began to expand, and of course property owners began to look at the suburbs. Now, for instance, there was no public lighting beyond about Donnybrook there. Once you came into the Stillorgan Road around Nutley there, you were in the dark. And
was it an old country road? I mean, it, the road from the Bray Road in.
That was the Bray Road that we're on now. That's a narrow road. Took all the traffic from Bray.
And so was it really out of the country? It was a village out of the country.
Out in the country. My cousins used to come out to the country for a day from the city. They lived in the city and they would come out to the country for a day. We lived in a field here. When we moved over here, we eventually moved over in 1938. These people remained on for 3 years, but we came over here in 1938 and we were still in a field. There was nothing else. A man had begun to build more bungalows down there. The post office was there. That was there in the early 30s, about 33, where Esmond Motors' office is now. And then there was a vacant space and somebody built those two bungalows.
Well, previous to that, the post office was across the road beside the
pub. At the very bottom of the hill. When I was growing up, it was at the bottom of the hill in one of the a two-storey house beside the pub. But it was divided by a laneway which went around the back of the houses on the hill.
And was it a good place to live? I know you were saying that there was a lot of people who were out of work.
Yeah, it was a nice, pleasant place. Everybody knew everybody else in it. Mm-hmm. It was a real village. Now, we were a little bit out of the village, and my mother came from Dublin. My father was from Kilkenny, and he died about 5 years after they were married. So she didn't know the people in Stillorgan. And I'd be a bad person to tell you what life was like with the neighbours in Stillorgan, because we didn't have neighbours. We had the school teacher beside us, who was a very busy lady. She had a big family, and she wouldn't be there all day. My mother was there all day. She would be away teaching. And then she was busy later because she had a large family. And they moved away in 1938 when we moved over here. They moved down to Black Rock. They built a house somewhere down in Stillorgan Park. And they moved. But my mother was a bit isolated in that she didn't know the people. So we always took a bus to town.
So where did you meet? The two of you.
Of course, you see, we're a small village, everybody.
No, I don't think we ever met.
I mean, Kathleen's brothers went to school with me, we all knew each other.
Yes, I was.
From an early age, And what was I going to say there? Something about the...
I suppose at that... So what year did you get married?
We got married in 1958.
58, yeah. Oh, I see. So, in fact, you were well established at that stage in New Ireland.
And now the place was little known, till after the war. It's amazing how few people in Dublin City ever heard of Kilmacud. A few had heard of Stillorgan, but Kilmacud. I remember a fellow coming into the office one day, one of the staff, and he said, "I've just seen a bus in the city," he said, "and there's a strange name on it, Kilmacud, K-I-L-M-A-C-U-D. Yeah, you see, he never heard of the place before. And that's the thing. And I remember another fellow retired, and he was talking about his life in the office. He had started to work in 1926. He was saying most of the staff at that time had come from the Dublin City area. And then he said, fellows with rosy cheeks came in from places like Kilmacud. They were out in the mountains, you see. But there was very little movement, in those.
But like you said, after the war years, things started to...
Things started to expand, grow. The building increased. That's the first shopping centre was opened in 1966. That's the first shopping centre in Ireland.
That was a Williams Group, was it?
No, Metropolitan Property Company, MEPC, London group. Yeah. There were a number of, there was an Irish director, Tim Phillips of Ballyfree, was on it. Kennedy Kish was a company lawyer and a businessman in London. He was a principal director in it, you see. And
Why did they choose Stillorgan to build the first supermarket?
It's proximity to Dublin, I suppose, 5 miles out on a main road, you know, leading from the city. There's a lot to be said for it. And it meant that in building the shopping centre, they had to handle what happened was a number of the houses were privately owned that were on the Kilmacud Road, small houses admittedly, but they were privately owned, some of them, and they were compensated. Anyone who owned this property was compensated, but anyone who didn't own the property, the local landlord was compensated, of course, you see, and the council undertook to rehouse the people. And in the meantime, the property company built temporary chalets up here at Glen Alban. And they accommodated the people until the council had built the scheme for them, you see.
Oh, I see. So, in fact, the estates started to...
Sometime in the 50s, wasn't it? Yes, you see, it was all farmland from Kilmacud Road, you say, from Kilmacud Church to Goatstown, you know, and Dundrum. That was all farm land, and there were an awful lot of dairy farms around the area. You see, of course, at that time you had 2 deliveries of milk per day, you know, and there were an awful lot of dairy farms around the area, and they were all busy. And then, of course, they faded out and their land was sold for development. And
who were the people then coming out here to live? Where were they working?
Mostly, Mount Marion was civil servants, and the people out here were people who had jobs in the city, and most of them were, it was a lot of Guinness workers, you know, one would get a house and then people would come out and have a look at that and they'd come, because I think it was so convenient to the city, and yet they were out of the city.
This was before the war.
No. When the war was, when they began to build the houses.
The bulk of the housing, like at that time, then was local authority housing. Bowfield had been built in 1939. Yeah, it was completed just before the war, and there was a kind of an old semi-slum area there, Jolly's Lane in Stillorgan, where the housing was particularly bad. That had been cleared out and rehoused in Bowfield, you see, and then a lot of Kilmacud Road, they moved to Bowfield, and then St. Lawrence's Park was built later on, you know. Yes. And so that there were
the private housing up to about 1950, that over there, Lyndon Lee, now they were built just 50, before my mother died, 1950. And that's when it happened, and then it just exploded, just like everybody.
Then all the area between Stillorgan and Goatstown, of course, was nearly built. Yes. Starting Reedsdale Estate was built in started in the 1950s too. They were occupied in the 1950s, you know.
Mm. And a lot of these houses, they were all very similar, weren't they? The 1950s, they were council type houses.
Dublin County Council built a kind of a standard house, 4 apartments. Without a bathroom up to the poor years. 4 apartments without a bathroom. There was good garden, good rear garden, and a lot of them had good front gardens. They were great houses. There was plenty of scope for extension then, do you see, on them. And the houses in Ballantyre were the same design, you know, you see. They were built by the County Council as well as Bowfield.
Yes.
And some of the houses around the Dunleary area were a little bit different. They were built by Dunleary Borough Corporation, which was a separate local body, you know. And
Bowfield was a very nice one because there weren't that many houses. There weren't how many houses? Which? It would be 50 in
In Bopi, about 60, I think. About 60 houses in Bopi.
And it's nice, it's very well laid out.
Compact estate, yeah.
And you're in off the road. Yes. In the public eye, you went in off the road to them.
Yes.
Which is lovely. It's a very nice estate, that. And sign is on it, the original families are still there, their grandchildren are still in these houses.
Very valuable house.
Very valuable now.
A lot of them then were sold to the tenants, you see, but under a purchase scheme run by the local authority. And the rent still, like even the repayments were low, you know, and eventually they owned them, and of course they sold them then in the housing boom.
Talk to me about the council. It's the county council here in Dublin that were responsible for these houses.
Yeah, that would be Dublin County Council. Now that covered the boundary of Dunleary Borough up to Swords, up to the north, County Dublin, all the west side of the city here, all that area covered by Fingal County Council and South Dublin Council, you see. That was all part of the original County Council. And the people, the councillors, were representative of the whole area, you know, there were men from, say, Paddy Burke, you remember him? Yeah. Well, Paddy, I remember Paddy electioneering out here, you know,
So, was there a tight bond? I'm thinking now in two.
No, you see, the local allegiance was always there, you know, North County people were North County people and South County people were South County people, you know, but there were, for the administration, they were all in the one council, you know, yes, that time.
And the people locally here, were they very, was there a community spirit, was there?
There was always a good community spirit.
As far as the was concerned, it was fairly village-like, it was a village, you see, and Dunleary, of course, was very much a unit of its own. You know, Dunleary had it was long established there way back before the state was set up. And a lot of men now, in the area, had been too involved in the, there was quite, of course, a lot of ex-British Army men from World War One, of course, alive at that time, you know. And then the British Ministry of Pensions retained control under the treaty of the hospital in Leopardstown, where the old people are now. Well, that hospital had a huge number of patients after the First World War. I mean, they used to go out here and exercise, bring them round the area, walk them round, might be 200 or 300 men, you see, in a special blue uniform, British veterans uniform, it was hospital uniform, and they'd be around, there'd be men there with all kinds of wounds, men with one arm and one leg and in wheelchairs and all kinds of things, all wounded men. And of course, any of them that were living at home who'd been former members of the British Army before the treaty, they were still being treated if they for any illness they got, you see. It was all done in Leopardstown Hospital. That was really outside the control of the early state, you know, you see. It was part of the British Ministry of Pensions.
When you think of those people, and a lot of them shell-shocked.
Shell-shocked and all that, yeah. Well, shell-shock was a common thing, yes. But you see, it gave employment too, you see. A lot of ex-soldiers here in the village, men who had been in the British Army, were able to get a bit of employment there, you see, from time to time, you know, you see. And in the hospital, the grounds and everything
and
that
happened. The women got it in the hospital, the women were working in the hospital.
Yeah, you know, they had small jobs up there. But that's all gone now, of course. There was a hospital there, I suppose. I don't know when they opened that hospital, but I wouldn't be surprised if it had been there during the First World War, you know.
Yeah.
There was a hospital in Black Rock at that time, Avondale, that was a military hospital during the First World War. you see, and of course, like men who have been discharged on medical grounds were sent over there for convalescence, you know, and the shell shock being one of the principal reasons too, you know. But
did your father, you know, the I'm just thinking of him implied with the sisters, the Carmelite nuns.
Yeah.
And you said it was closely, it was an enclosed order.
Yes, up to Vatican II.
Yeah, yeah.
It was strictly enclosed, contemplative order. Yeah. They didn't have any communication with the outside world, except by letter or...
But how did your father ever bring home stories about the place? And
he did. Like in now, for instance, during the war years, the convents and places like that were told to take special measures for the security of any valuable plate they had, like goldware or silverware or anything like that. Like there'd be sacred vessels, you know, and. I always remember my father digging a big hole in the kitchen of the convent, and they put down a kind of a chest full of any monstrances, chalices, ciboria, anything that weren't in use. And they were all, then it was covered over with a flagstone in the kitchen in case there'd be an invasion, things would be looted, you see, be taken by any invading force, you see.
This was during the emergency.
During the emergency,
yeah.
For instance, I had been in the LDF during the war. And at the end of the war, I rejoined the FCA as it was founded. And I was in every rank of the force. I was private, corporal, sergeant, second lieutenant, captain and commandant.
Were you?
Yeah.
So, was it frustrating not being able to do the same in the company, being able to climb up that ladder?
Well, it helps, you see. The training helps, you see, it does. The training within and any force like that helps you, even in your civilian employment. And particularly in an area like personnel, it's a great help. Because
the discipline.
Because you have, you know, you're supposed to be able to handle people, do you see? Like, yes, you see.
Right, but yes, okay. Yes. So it benefited you. But going from, say, the officer, personnel officer.
Yeah, yeah.
What would be the next stage up if you were to get it?
Well, the next stage up from personnel officer would be, say, a personnel manager somewhere, you see.
And did you make that?
No, for instance, I was within 6 weeks of retirement. And I got a ring one day from one of the leading appointment agencies in Dublin to tell me that they were headhunting me for a job as personnel manager of an oil company.
What oil company was it?
I don't know which it was, but I have a suspicion at that time there was a vacancy in Shell. It may have been theirs, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I wouldn't know. They didn't give me the name. But I mean, I didn't entertain it for 5 minutes. I said to him, obviously, you don't know how old I am. I said, I'm within 6 weeks of retirement. Yeah.
I suppose they saw your
Well, you see, that's what happens there with that, is you get known in the business, you see. If you're moving in and out of these, you're attending an odd seminar or an odd meeting of personnel people, and they get to know you, that you're, you know, and then very often you get queries from others, like saying, well, I've such a problem and I was wondering how you'd handle it, you know, and so forth, you know. And you talk to each other that way, you know, through it. Yeah.
Was there that fear that
there was a real danger of it. I mean, just no doubt about it, within hours of it at some stages, you see.
And being in the LDF, were you on alert?
Well, we were alert. We were alerted at the time of the American note now in 1944. That was, I hadn't been there now, but there was a stand to in Christmas 1940 for the whole South. They would thought the British were going to invade at that stage.
Yeah.
And... then the Americans made a demand for the ports in 1944, and there was a stand to then immediately, and it only lasted a few days because the American ambassador delivered a letter to the government asked them to hand over the port, like, you know, it was a more or less a demand. And De Valera got in touch with the American government straight away to get a guarantee from them that they did not intend to take any action against the country. And they said that they wouldn't take any action. Then it passed over, you see. The reason was that this man, the ambassador here at that time, was a man named Gray. He was distantly related to President Roosevelt. Or the government here would have demanded his recall because he was meddling in affairs here. And there were stories circulated in America that we were helping U-boats and everything here, you know, and all this kind of thing. That the country was pro-German, you see, and whereas it wasn't really, you know, there was more help given to the Allies than ever was given to Germany, you know.
But when there was a scare that the British would actually invade,
well, you see, the army here had to have two plans. They had to have a plan in the event of a British invasion, and they had to have a plan in the event of a German invasion. You see,
what was the difference between?
Well, the difference between them was this. If the Germans invaded, you would have to seek British aid immediately and Allied aid. If the British invaded, you'd have to seek German aid, you see. Well, now, it would be very difficult to get German aid at that time because the Germans were on the way down, you see. But like there were plans like about the British force coming down from the north would come down and occupy, say, the Cora area, you know, and the two, what was there of an Irish Defence Force would take them on, you see, to fight the invader, you see. But that'd be, you see, and you'd have British air support, of course, you know, like, and all that, you know.
But were you really prepared to tackle any invasion?
Oh, yes. Oh, well, we were told, like, to be ready for it, you know. There was no question about that, like, that we were told it was coming. I always remember that well. I remember E.A. Maguire, who was the district leader of the LDF here. He was a senator afterwards, and he was the managing director of Brown Thomas, you know, the firm, the big shop. And he was a Cambridge-educated man. I remember he came down here when that note was delivered, and he addressed the LDF in the hall over there, myself. And he said that it looked bad. The American government had made a demand that no government could agree to accept it, you see. And that, like, it'd have to be resisted if there was an American occupation. But, of course, it was very unlikely there'd be much of a resistance because what would we be able to do against the Americans? You know, I mean, you see, without air, without your own air superiority, it'd be very hard to do anything, you know, yes?
Well, what about the bombing that happened in Dublin? The
bombing was in 1941.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember the night well. I remember the house shaking, the window shaking, and all the firing. The anti-aircraft fire was, of course, was fairly heavy, and the bombs then were, and then the huge big bang, that was the bomb that did the most damage in the North Strand. It was a special type of bomb, kind of a landmine that was dropped by the German Air Force. And it's never been properly explained. The most credible explanation is that the British had developed some system of bending the navigation rays, you know, like that the planes were using, and that the planes were all losing their sense of direction. And right enough, any of the eyewitnesses will tell you that if you looked at the sky, there were planes flying north and planes flying south, you know. Like, you see, and whether they knew they were over Dublin or not, I don't know. Then, of course, when they come under fire, you see, anyway, they dropped whatever bombs they had, but it was common for them if they were being pursued, say, by the RAF, and the plane was damaged, get rid of the bombs to be safer, if you had to make a forced landing, to land with bombs, you know, because your plane would blow up as well, you know. But that went on, and, like, of course, you were prepared for it. Like, now, for instance, there were such things as there were a number of trees now that were known that would be knocked down if there was an invasion, like to block all roads, you know, and all that kind of thing, and keep certain roads open, you know. And You see, the LDF's main function at that time was to obstruct an enemy until the regular forces and whatever aid we're getting could get on the ground, you know, like this. So do you see, they had that, they had to have that arrangement with the British in case there'd be a German invasion. And then, of course, they had to the British had to be aware that if they would be resisted if they invaded on their own, you know, you see, that type of thing.
And was there support for the Nazis in Ireland?
There was a small number of Nazis in Ireland. See, the Nazi Party had a special branch of the party for overseas members. And there were a number of Irish people in it. There were a number of Irish scholars, like scholars involved, or German scholars, like, who were employed by the Irish state in the museum and places like that, you see. There was the man there, Marr, M-A-R-R, even the museum, he was a Nazi. Colonel Fitzbrazzi at the Army School of Music was a member of the Nazi Party.
Oh, were they working undercover?
They were working, well, they were found out afterwards. They weren't, that, but they would have been undercover in the early days, but I'd say, all right, you know. But they weren't ever preparing, like, for an invasion of Ireland. They were Nazis, like, by conviction type of thing. But, like, the IRA declared war on England in 1939, you see. And the Germans, strangely enough, seemed to be under the impression that anywhere outside a big town in Ireland or Dublin City, Cork, Limerick and Galway and those, was controlled by the IRA. And like agents landed here, there were about 15 to 20 agents captured here from time to time, landed in Ireland. Now I saw the equipment they carried. They had maps of the area, they had radios. They had an attaché case a little bigger than that, which had contained the radio. There was one fellow landed in the Midlands, and he walked into a local village and he asked for the local IRA commander. He was arrested promptly and put into the corral. You see, they had given this impression, like, you see, that they were in charge of the country, like, of course they weren't. And like there were all these, and of course we never had. They did contact. They did make contact with the army here, and I think the contact was mainly through Hugo MacNeil, who was Major General in the army here. You know, the Germans now were kind of a roundabout contact. We couldn't get any arms during the war. You see, Ireland at the beginning of the war could have bought arms openly, but when they became neutral, you see,
yeah,
established as a neutral country. And then, of course, when all these propaganda and Clay Gray and all these were sending messages to American government saying the place here was overrun by Nazis, it was very hard to buy anything abroad, you see.
And so what kind of military armoury did you have? I mean, what were you using?
We had rifles mainly. Rifles, we had some machine guns, we had very little in the way. We had a small amount of artillery, not a big amount of it. It was mainly obsolete, you know. And then, of course, we had a limited supply of ammunition for these weapons, you see. Now, through the good offices of the Canadian government, I think it was, we got a big supply of Springfield and rifles, American rifles, for the LDF at the time. They were a good weapon. They were quite an inserted weapon. And the ammunition, they were 3.30 caliber, whereas the British Lee entries are 0.303, you know. So the ammunition wasn't interchangeable, you know, like you had to have special ammunition for the American ones, you see.
And what kind of training were you doing?
We would do, apart from the drills and the weapon training, like the use of the weapon, the shooting and the assembling of the weapon and all that kind of thing. And we also were trained in the use of incendiary grenades, you see. See, there was a little unit set up here, mainly of science graduates, some of them are in the army, to develop this. And they developed a smaller top cocktail, you see, like it's done in bottles. Full of a mixture of petrol and various things in the bottle of phosphorus, and the bottle was sealed and it was scored at the side, and if you threw this bottle against the wall, I think as soon as it exploded, broke, the air set the phosphorus on fire, and you could the wall would be ablaze in seconds. You see. These were a handy weapon against armoured vehicles. See, if you hit the tank with two or three of these, you'd nearly roast the people in it, you know.
So, but they were homemade bombs.
They were homemade bombs. You see, well, they did a lot of those. Bailey Butler now is a man. He was a professor who lived out in Howth. He was one of the men who developed that. And Vivian de Valera, of course, was a science graduate. You know, like he could do a bit of that work too. And he was a major in the army, you see. There were a number of these men like that had an interest in that. And the army intelligence work, of course, was quite good, you see.
Was it now?
Oh, it was. Oh, God, it was, yeah. Oh, yes. I mean, the IRA made no moves here that they didn't know about, you know. Like, they were, they'd covered that pretty well. But then there were pretty amateurish ways, you know. For instance, Colonel Archer, who was at one time head of intelligence, and he became chief of staff of the army afterwards, but he was a senior colonel. He was getting off at a bus, I think it was, at McKee Barracks. Some people approached him for support for the IRA. He arrested them himself, brought them into the barracks, turned them.
So would some of this knowledge, information have passed on to the IRA at the time, the Republicans?
Yeah, well, there wasn't that much contact, official contact. You see, the IRA was fighting the police force here as well, you see, and the army, like, you know, the state here was under attack as well from the IRA, you see.
Oh, were the LDF involved in protecting?
Well, the LDF, no, they didn't have any protection to do with. They weren't involved in that dispute at all. It was the regular force, like, and the guards, like, were involved in. All the guards were armed, of course, at banks and all that kind of thing, you know, because the robberies in banks, you know, steal money. You know, that was going on quite a lot, yeah.
But would some of the members of the IRA have been in the LDF?
They could well have been, for all we know.
Yeah,
they would well have been, you know, that could well have happened. And the British had their intelligence people here too, you see, during the war. You see, they were very well represented here. And
were you aware of them? Did you know who they were?
Well, the LDF was a force. There were men of all sides in it. Like, for instance, we had men here, like, who were out-and-out Republicans. And we had men whose relatives were in senior officers in the British Army. You remember one man in the district here, and he had a relative who was a general, one of the men leading the British attack in Normandy, you know.
Really, yes.
Yeah, you see, like, there were Irish men in all those. Mm. You see, men of all allegiance, but they had a common allegiance to Ireland at that time. But the only thing I did notice at the end of the war is a lot of these faded away, like, you know.
Yeah.
They were probably there primarily to resist a German invasion, I'd say, you know, like, you see.
So you joined it at the beginning of the war?
I didn't join until 1944. I wasn't of age, you see, to then to join.
So you were 17 or 18?
I was 17, yeah, and I joined in February 1944. I was there for the American note, and I was there for the up to the end of the war, you know.
You were, and you climbed rank very fast.
Well, then I went into the FCA.
Yeah.
As a private, and like, I went up then in the FCA, you see.
Yeah.
And
so you liked the whole military?
Oh, I liked it, yeah. I liked it, yeah. And I would have liked to have been a full-time soldier, you know.
What's the attraction? Why?
Well, I don't know. It just did appeal to young people at that time, you know. They were remarkable young people at that time here. Like, the one thing about a lot of those young people at that time, there were servicing in the army here and that type of thing. They were prepared to die in the thing, you know.
So, Paddy Rochford, thank you very much indeed.
Not at all. Not at all. It's a pleasure. If you want to add more to it at any time, give me a shout.
Oh, I'll be back.
Yeah, right.